third phase, actually the second phase, of the faith rest drill under faith functions. We're just about ready to move into the final stage, which of course will be faith execution, but that of course will come up a little bit later on in our study. That is the third and final section. All right, when you take something to the Supreme Court, you better be sure that you have a proper analysis, that you have all the information necessary, that you are accurate in your approach, and that you do not change from being the plaintiff and become the defendant because you, in fact, inspired or actually fostered that which you supposedly received unjustly. Commonly referred to as leading with your chin or walking around with a spiritual chip on your shoulder, someone is going to try to knock it off. Arrogance, of course, is one area where you never want to take your case to the Supreme Court of Heaven because you will be directly, you'll be directly disciplined. Anything that has to do with a lack of authority orientation, you are going to be disciplined. You never, ever have the right to criticize an authority over you, whether it be in the local church or in a business. You cannot take that to the Supreme Court because regardless of what the quality of the authority is, it is still the authority. Some people have never learned that. And I understand the young people last night learned about basic authority under the laws of establishment, whether you go for it or not. I've said repeatedly that I don't particularly like Bill Clinton. I don't think he's a good president, but he is still the authority, and I must respect the position that he holds as the President of the United States. The fact of the matter is, we don't always have to like the individual, but we do not have the right to conspire against them, to make issues with that regard, to try to get them out of office by force, or in any way try to undermine the authority of the individual. Now see, you military types, you understand that, because you learn that early in your basic training. I can always tell the difference between one who has served in the military and one who hasn't. The one who hasn't always has an arrogance toward authority. Well, I'm here to tell you that that would have been knocked out of you within the first 40 days. And you'd have either made it or you'd have been broken. And you'd be behind bars. Because they don't tolerate the lack of authority. The whole thing in the balance of military honor code is authority and chain of command. A lot of people don't understand chain of command. Kurt and I were just talking about that very thing recently, and we were saying that this church is really run on military protocol from the standpoint of authority. I'm the commander, and anyone that comes in who is to be my assistant would act exactly the same as an executive officer would act directly under the commander in a relationship. Then you have the various sub-commanders. We might look at them kind of as deacons. And then those, of course, who are subordinate to them in their various committees and meetings and functions, etc., etc. And once you understand that, and that is far from being a congregational form of government. We are not a congregational form of government. We're set up a lot like our great republic, at least in theory. This is not a democracy. Most churches are run as a democracy. That fosters chaos. No democracies succeed. Only republics succeed. And a republic is, well, if you don't know the difference, you ought to study the difference. The United States of America is a republic, not a democracy, in spite of what you hear on the news and all the other left-wing commie pinkos that are always trying to sell us on the idea that we're a democracy. We are not. Never were, and hopefully we never will be. Unfortunately, we're going very speedily in that direction. Just like that myth about separation of church and state. That's a myth. What the Constitution or the bylaws say is that you will have no church overruling the government of the nation. Don't say anything about separation of church and state, because the intent of our founding fathers was to have God as an integral part of the government of this nation. Read them, you'll be intrigued. You see, the problem is we still have what they said recorded. And when we read what they had to say, well, it sounds a lot different than what we're hearing today about the spirit of the founding father. The spirit of the founding fathers of this nation was God-honoring. We even put it on our coins. How dare we do that? Of course, it's a farce in most cases, because certainly in God we do not trust. You know, for a while, I don't know how many of you are alive then, they actually removed that from the coins. There was a time when it did not appear, and I guess there was enough of a furor where they put it back on again. And so too with the Christian life. You've got a case. Don't ever go to the Lord and the Supreme Court of Heaven and start complaining about your pastor, for example. That's not for you to do. You've got to appreciate the fact that there's someone that gave him the gift and you didn't. And that someone that gave him that ministry and you didn't. And that someone that gave him that congregation and you didn't. And that someone that moved him into that geographical locale under the geographical will of God, and it's not your will, so what have you got to complain about? Well, I don't like your policies. Tough. Too bad. They work. And after 27 years, I've become more and more firm in the policies that I established. And we have a very simple policy here that kind of undermines the whole thing or underlines the whole thing. If you don't like it, go somewhere else where you can cause trouble. Isn't that easy? Some people, I guess, got the idea the policies are made to be argued and broken. We have people here at Westside, by the way, that think that all policy is designed for other people, but never designed for them, that there's some exception to the rule, and there are no exceptions to the rule. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm infallible, and that certainly doesn't mean that I'm not going to make mistakes. I'm going to make mistakes. But, you know, the Lord has a strange way of bringing these out in my ministry, in my life, without your help. Not that I'm suggesting, of course, that any of you have tried to guide me directly within the last few nights. But every so often, one of you come to me with your famous ideas. I don't listen to you because I could care less. If God says it, I'm going to sit up and take notice, because I'm in trouble if I don't obey Him. But you see, I've learned a long time ago that pastors don't obey their congregations. And the ones that do are congregation whipped, and they're wimps. They never speak the truth. They're afraid to speak the truth for fear they might, in some way, offend someone in the congregation. Well, if I was out for that, we'd probably be up now, after 27 years, to about 4,000 or 5,000 people. You see the size of Westside? You can see I haven't changed. People have come to me 25 years after they left and thanked me for what I gave them while they were here and what they could have had. Unfortunately, they were gone for 25 years. That bothers me. That hurts. I've seen families divided. I've seen situations where a son or a daughter would decide they're going to come to Bible class regardless of their backslidden, legalistic, wayward parents, as adults, of course. And they did. And they're still here. and they're growing, and they're serving, and God is blessing. You say, what about the parents? Misery, discord, confusion. I didn't cause that. People used to go up to Dan Hill when he'd meet them in various places, and they'd say, and I quote, "The worst thing I ever did in my life was when I left Westside Bible Church." And so he would say, "Well, then why don't you come back?" And here was their response. What will they say if I came back? And you know what the answer is? Absolutely nothing. I'm not going to get up here and say, "Well, it's good to see so-and-so after 15 years. It's about time you drug your butt back in here again." I'm not going to do that. I protect their privacy just as I tried to while they were here. You might even look at them as visitors, and fine, they might try to impress you with the fact that they put one of the stones in the building. Say, that's nice. I'm glad you're so tolerant, because we as a church, for the most part, are tolerant, with rare exception. And the rare exception always make it bad for the rest. See, all you need is one vocal big mouth that really, unfortunately, is the one that everyone wants to quote as the philosophy of a particular organization. That's not the way it works. Take it from the mass, from the entirety. If there's one person that doesn't like it and 50 that do, that tells you something. Look at even the vote that they took over in California. It was 75-5 to call Bob as their pastor. You say, what was wrong with the five? Probably out of fellowship. Simple enough. Of course, you say, well, you're biased. Aren't we all? When it comes to Bob? I mean, who can reject Bob? How dare they say no? How many of you know, by the way, what he was on the list of candidates that they had already come through there and minister? Do y'all know? 10th? 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, close. Can you imagine? And they rejected every one of them. Except when our Bobby Jill walked in. And then they even came here to see what made us tick. And they liked what they heard. One guy even told Bob, if we don't accept you, from what I've heard about your pastor, I'm moving to Arizona. Isn't that great? Of course, the couple that was here last Sunday admitted to me, after listening to me speak, now they know where Bob got a lot of his stuff. Where else do you expect him to get it? He's been here for 25 years. He came in as a teenager. A 14-year-old brat with his own ideas. And he was even going to advise me one day. I remember this great advice that he gave me, and I said, there's the door, Jack. He and the rest of the young people were going to let me know what they thought and how they were going to straighten me out. Now, they didn't straighten me out at all. I straightened them out, straight out the door. And they still stayed. And he began to understand a fundamental principle of spiritual growth, subordination to authority. If you don't have it, I'm here to tell you, you're never going to grow, ever. How can your faith rest in something if you don't understand subordination to authority? Here's some principles I'd like you to get down in dealing with this third function of the faith rest drill, and that is faith correlation and coordination. Here's where you begin to mix the promises of God so that they combine together in a majestic effort to ward off all of the adversities that we are confronted with on a daily basis. See, sometimes you have to combine the problem-solving devices. They don't stand isolated by themselves. We know that occasionally, you can, for a simple act of adversity, you can apply just one. But there are those where you have to combine one and three and five and seven. And behind it all is always faith rest. Always faith rest. Really, if I were to redraw the thing, I would have nine problem-solving devices with the stabilizer being the faith rest drill. Because you see, whether you have the nine or the ten, without faith rest, none of them operate properly. So they are all totally and absolutely dependent upon faith rest. You've got to leave it in the hands of the Lord. You see, you claim the promise of the problem-solving device. And then you rest in the Lord that He's going to work this thing out. You've got to leave it in His hands. So there it is, rest again, regardless of what it is. So under point three, in faith perception, is faith correlation and coordination. When you depend upon the circumstances of life for your happiness, it is inevitable that spiritually you will fail miserably and end up a loser. The circumstances of life have to be related, as we've previously seen, realistically through the eyes of Scripture, accepted for what they are, and then placed into the hands of the Lord and relaxed. If you're only happy when your circumstances are happy, you're not going to be a very happy person, because eventually, you see, you're going to narrow it down to about three or four things. And those three or four things may not occur, but about maybe every 3 or 4 months. Which means that the rest of the time, you will become a casualty and a victim to your own circumstances. What am I actually saying? This is what I'm saying. Regardless of the circumstances in life, you can have inner happiness. Even though the world looks at you and says, "How come? How can you do that? If I had that happen to me, I'd be miserable." Now, right now, I've got a whole house full, with the exception, the only two that have survived this thing that's going around is Krisha and I. And so Krisha's in nursery. That's her Bible class. She looks forward to that. And by the way, you may not realize how monumental it is that she actually left the house without my wife or her daddy. She just said, "Bye, we're leaving." And, you know, I took one look at her, and she took my hand, and we went right to the car, and I said, "All right." After all this time. But she didn't quite know how to figure me out. For what it's worth, she never will. That's how you keep them hopping. My kids, when they were growing up, they finally got to the point where they knew between the first and second admonition, and the second admonition generally brought about wrath after the first and second admonition. You know what the Scripture says? Reject. Well, I can't reject my kids, so I used to beat them up. Well, you know what I mean. I used to spank them. Well, they knew that there was a time delay. Yeah. There was a time delay between first and second admonition, and they timed it down to the point where about a second before I unleashed my wrath, they would do it. So I really fooled them. I shortened that time by half. blew their minds. Hey, I still have 0.8 seconds left. Blew their minds. And I had them going that way for at least 18, 19 years. And it was wonderful because finally they said, I can't figure this man out. Never did, never will, that's fine. The only one that has to understand me is the Lord and my wife, as far as who I am in character. The only one that has to understand me in Bible class is all of you. It's amazing how God can use character to communicate doctrine. Say, yes, you are a character. Well, I hope so. That means I have one. I've met people that were zero character. You can get the same response out of a lampshade. You ever feel like you were talking to one? That's the response you get. And then after they open your mouth, you'd rather be talking to the lampshade? Talk about superficiality. God intends for you to share His happiness. We took up an entire almost 6-month period on Sunday morning and Sunday evening dealing with sharing the happiness of God. Well, how can you share the happiness of God if you're going around miserable all the time? That's not God's intent. But you see, to share someone else's happiness, there is a contingency. You got to play with the rules that the man or the person has established that will lend you that happiness. If you're not going to abide by the rules, if you're not going to abide by divine policies, don't expect to share the happiness of God, because that's a part of His commitment to policy. I've never had anyone come up to me and say, I've been filled with the Spirit, I am filled with the Spirit, I abide in every mandate and policy that God has ever given me, and I'm not a happy person. No, to the contrary. As a matter of fact, they don't have to tell me that, because I see it manifest in their life. And some of you must be really, really unhappy, because you look that way most of the time. You know, for you to smile, I don't know what it would take. And that is an expression of joy, is it not? You know, physiologically, it takes more muscles to frown than it does to smile. So it's even easier to smile than it is to frown. It takes work to frown. But apparently some of you practiced it. And I watch you sometimes. Things are said here where other people are roaring with an expression of happiness because they thought it was funny. And you're just sitting there like the great stone face. You look like one of those monuments in Montana. Is that where it is? North Dakota. It's close. I don't know much about the Great Northwest. That's South Dakota. That's South Dakota. You see, we're all wrong. You know, the mountains, Mount Rushmore. Some of you look that way. Never, you know. I've seen roosters have more expression. I love to study animals. What a picture of people. What a picture of people. I was searching hard for illustrations because of the environment that I was in at the time. I had to speak on a Sunday morning at Gene's congregation in Arkansas. And I thought, what am I going to give these people? I had the text. But you know, I don't walk with one foot in the furrow. And I don't have that delivery. Well, here we are, you know, that kind of thing. That's as slick as a greased pig. I just That is not a part of my general, you know. So this fellow that we were staying with and his wife had Canadian geese. Apparently, the Canadian government had worked with the Arkansas government, and they were going to bring in hundreds of thousands of Canadian geese. He told me why, but it didn't, you know, I didn't register it because it didn't matter to me. But anyway, here in his front yard, or his backyard actually, which goes down into the Arkansas River, quite picturesque, there were probably about 400 or 500 Canadian geese. Beautiful animals. Watch where you step, however. And there was one that was missing a foot. They called her Peg. Yeah. And she would kind of hobble around. And I noticed she always sat by herself. They would never care for her. I don't know if you know anything about Canadians. Geese. I'm not talking about people from Canada. See, southern Canadians go honk. Up there they go howk. Anyhow, you ever hear them say house? It's house. Anyway, house. You can always pick someone from Canada. They always have that funny way of pronouncing their OUs. It's like Bible school Greek. They get together and they have families. Okay, they actually have families, like little congregations. And they put point guards out. They have one on looking this way, and they face that way. Another one facing this way, another one facing that way, another one facing that way. And they're always ready for danger. And the minute the one gives the call, they all take off together, unified, and start flying around. So there were these pacts, or congregations, for lack of a better expression, and poor Peg. None would allow her in. What an illustration. What an illustration. I worked that for at least 15 minutes. About not wanting certain people in the church because they didn't quite look the same as the others. She was missing a foot, poor thing. She'd actually gotten caught in a trap, and she pulled loose, but she lost her foot in the process. Now you feel sorry for poor Peg, don't you? I'd probably go there right now, and Peg would be sitting there all by herself. And then when they'd go to eat, he'd throw bread out there for them. And, of course, they could all scamper because they had two good legs and two good flappers. You know, those webbed feet. And nothing funnier, by the way, to, you know, they are so regal when they're in the air. But, boy, do they look stupid when they're running on the ground. They're not ground animals. And here comes poor Peg. And she'd always get there too late. They'd snap up that bread and run off with it. So they'd have to have a separate feeding just for her. That's like some of you with your private counseling nonsense. But you've got both your feet. And so he'd throw her the bread, and he'd have to shoo the others away. And then the mallards would come in. He has a whole bunch of mallards. And they'd get to the bread before she did. And she'd had a young one, and they completely disregarded her. Because she was the outcast. Animals are interesting to study. Getting back to what I said earlier, some of you look typical of some animals that I've seen. They never smile. They don't have much of a sense of humor. I'm sorry you're hurting, but it may be because you're not with God's program. God's program invokes joy. It invokes happiness. You share his happiness. Your happiness is not circumstantial. your happiness is derived directly from God. Imagine, God says, how would you like to share my happiness? No, I'd rather just have the mundane, everyday, circumstantial happiness that's afforded me in life. Are you going to be a very happy person? No. That was point A under point three. People who make you happy temporarily can also make you unhappy temporarily. Right? That's what people are all about. I'm sure in your list of priorities of tests, what's generally the first one on your list? People testing. Circumstantial testing, you can avoid that. But it's very difficult to avoid people. They're all around us, breathing on us, talking to us, cutting in line in front of us, talking on the line to the woman who's checking out, showing pictures of great, 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 great grandchildren of her great, 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 great grandfather. You can't drive an automobile and not be confronted with people, because it's people that sit behind the wheel of that automobile. And they do strange things. We do strange things. I caught myself the other day wandering into the other lane, and this poor gal gave me a look like, what are you doing? And I looked at her and I went, you know, I mouth. Of course, I had one vocally call me an AH recently, too. I said, that wasn't very feminine. You say, why did she call you that? Because I was at that point in the way I was maneuvering my automobile. I almost backed over her child. Oh, I did. Now, there are some things you should laugh about and some things you should be very serious about. And you people are laughing about things that I almost did. And instead of saying, I've seen the way some of you drive, too, and I might add, just to remind you, that the parking lot is not the Indianapolis 500. The speed limit is 3 miles an hour. I've noticed the way some of you come in. All right, you're late. You're not going to get here any sooner. As a matter of fact, one thing you won't get is chewed out for driving too fast, because we have little toddlers that you can't see in your headlights. And they don't know anything about the weight and mass and the whole idea of inertia and all that is involved in a motor-driven vehicle. Some of you don't either. But it takes so many feet to stop a vehicle traveling at a certain speed, and you can't stop in time. And I don't want to have any of you come in here with your head hung down to the floor saying, I can't believe I did that. I just ran over a child out there. So slow down and be on the alert. Some of them are really tiny, too. And some of them don't take heed from their parents. They get out of the car, you know, and right away, blah, they're running off in the middle of the parking lot. Well, don't say, well, that stupid parent, and then run their kid down. We've never had a mishap, and I don't wish to have one. We'll have to. We'll put a net barrier so it'll slow you down as you come in on your final approach. Like they do on an aircraft carrier, so you'll hit the net before, and maybe it'll catapult you back out onto 43rd so you can start it again, only this time with the right approach. Go back and do it again until you get it right. Then the barrier comes down, you see. Well, there'd be two timers out there, two lights, and if you cross those lights within a period of time, this barrier would go up and say, slow down, and then catapult you back out to the entrance of the driveway. Someday we'll have that. Either that or the ground will just open up and swallow you. That sounds familiar. All forms of pseudo-happiness are lost quickly. They don't last. And see, what is temporary, obviously, is not lasting. That may sound ludicrous and redundant, but it's a fact. And when you look at life realistically and build your life on pseudo-happiness, it's not going to last. So you might be roaring with laughter tonight about a situation or a circumstance, and tomorrow, because of that same situation and circumstance, conceivably you could be in tears. Whereas with God, it's always consistent. When you share His happiness, you're happy. And that doesn't mean to say you've got to go around like Alice's Cheshire cat with that smile on your face all the time. If you happen to be a smiling person, that's different. Some of us are not. I'm one of them. I don't go around with this look on my face. When I do that, it looks like I have to go. That's why I don't like pictures, because I can never get a natural smile on a picture. Person says, smile, I go. People who are photogenic, I guess, just have their jaw hung in a smiled position. Some of you have very attractive smiles. Some of you I wouldn't know. Therefore, God has provided a happiness in the soul which is far greater than pseudo-happiness without in life. You see, the thing is, this is an inner happiness. So you have a kind of a giggle going on all the time inside. Now let me ask you something. Based on that, if you share the happiness of God and you have this inner happiness, what kind of a person are you going to be on the outside? A happy person. You're going to be pleasant to be around. And how much antagonism are you going to have for your fellow man? Very little, if any. See, you're too occupied sharing the happiness of God. How much criticism are you going to have of your fellow believer, your brother in Christ? None. You're sharing the happiness of God. So you see, when you crank up all this lack of authority orientation and crank up all this criticism and bitterness and vindictiveness, I'll get even with them business, you're just saying something. You're not sharing God's happiness. You don't have a clue what inner happiness is all about. Some of you do, I can tell. Because you're happy whether you're feeling good or you're not. Getting back to my initial point, my entire household is down. My wife has had a relapse from what she had a few nights ago, and we have a friend living with us now, Evan, from California. He got up heaving this morning, went to work, his boss sent him home. John looks like, if he gets any worse, we'll bury him. The baby is recovering quickly. She had a pleasant smile on her face today, and her cheeks are getting rosier. But both barrels are still leaking, and she has a cough. Krish is the only one that has fully recovered, and I'm about 90% recovered as of last night. Well, I'm very thankful for that. But you know, there's one thing I've noticed. There is still peace, tranquility, and happiness in that household. My wife can feel miserable, and I take one look at her, and she smiles. That's inner happiness. Of course, when I'm sick and she looks at me, I frown. That did cause me to smile. Better write that down. Point B, sharing the happiness of God is not only a problem-solving device, but it is God's grace provision for true and sustaining happiness on earth in the midst of the greatest adversity or the greatest prosperity. Be reminded, as I mentioned previously, that the one thing that can really be a deterrent for you is prosperity. Some of you say, hey, let me try it. That would not be happiness for you. It might be absolute misery. Well, God, couldn't God just kind of give me a try? No, he knows what's good for you, even though we don't. If I were to pass out a sheet of paper and have you simply put N or Y on there and ask the question, how many of you would like to prosper starting tomorrow with ultimate prosperity? I doubt if there would be any N's on there, except the realistic ones who would say, and you'd probably be pseudo spiritual, and you'd say, well, if God wills. That wasn't the offer. How would you like to have maximum prosperity in your life from the time that you wake up in the morning? That might be the greatest cause of misery in your life. Because see, what's the missing link for prosperity? Capacity, thank you. And without capacity, prosperity becomes adversity. I might add, just so that we can at least clear the air in this area in case we have any racists here, happiness is not a matter of race. It is not confined to the white 21 Protestant, Republican, right-wing extremist. Liberals can be happy too. I don't know why or how, but they am. Happiness is not a matter of race, gender, class distinction, being rich or poor, our relationship with those whom we love is not the secret of our happiness. Did you get that? The relationship that we have with those we love is not the secret of our happiness. We take our happiness or the lack of it into that relationship. And what makes for a happy relationship in love is when the two people have happiness in their soul. That's why people are so miserable when they get married. They have the idea that marriage is going to result in happiness. Listen, marriage is not a problem-solving device. Marriage is a problem-causing device. If you never thought you had problems before, get married. And some people have to do it three or four times to get it right. And they still don't get it right. Been amazed over the years to see how people will remarry individuals they just got rid of, only they got a different name, different face, and different size. Make your happiness first, and that in your soul. And then you get two people who have soul happiness. Man, they can share that with each other remarkably. And everything else in the marriage falls in line. Does that mean you never disagree? No, it doesn't mean you never disagree. The woman hasn't lost her opinion. She hasn't lost her intellect. Subordination doesn't mean stupidity. It doesn't say let the wives become stupid in subordination to their own husbands. No. No. And sometimes you can sit down together and she can have good advice. I know it's hard, guys, but we have to admit, sometimes a woman has something to say that's far, far better than that crazy thing we came up with. And there has to be a willingness on our part to listen. Because I know we pride ourselves in having everything in control and that we know everything about everything under any circumstances. But we have sinks that are dripping in the, and toilets that won't shut off and so on. But we really have everything under control. One of these days, I'm going to fix my solar panels. It's only been a year. At least I keep talking about it. You say, well, why don't you do it? I don't like it. It's a nasty job. I've got to remove this 3/4-inch rod that's about 6 feet long. And I have since, well, over the years, I have very heavily greased it with thick bearing grease, assuming that it wouldn't wear out. Well, it did. And, of course, now it's skipping on the threads of the rod or the guide that is threaded. I'm not sure which of the two has to be replaced. But in any event, I have to remove both to get to it. The problem. And it's a nasty, sticky, filthy job. I even have rubber gloves. And they don't do me any good. Or those, you know, those surgical gloves. They cause my hands to sweat. And I don't like that either. Now, everybody together. Aww. Thank you so much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you, thank you, thank you. For my second number, a happiness which prevents the conversion of adversity and distress in the soul is the ideal happiness to have. Anything that will prevent adversity in your life, ending up stress in your life, is the happiness that comes from God. And that's why it's a problem-solving device. Now, it isn't that you look at this adversity superficially or just simply shrug it off, or any other word that you use to get rid of the situation. You just don't say, oh, well, that's it, and walk off. Oh, no. No, the happiness of God fills the believer's soul with that happiness, and you're able to face whatever the adversity is, and it never becomes stress. Remember, problem-solving devices are not problem-alleviating devices. They don't get rid of the problem necessarily. They solve the problem. There's a big difference between getting rid of something and solving something. An example, if you're married and you have an argument, you can solve the problem with your wife or get rid of her. Is that a solution? Generally not. Matter of fact, it oftentimes causes more troubles. Because then you have to go to court and settle all that business in front of a judge who doesn't know you from Adam. And if you're a woman, and you go in there with a few tears, you know, with a baby hanging from one breast, you've got it. Yes, $1,000 a day for the baby and $2,000 a day for the mother and $50,000 a year for... But, sir, I only make a dollar a week. 30 days in jail, and so on. These guys are getting obnoxious. Now the rights seem to be going to paternity principles. Man and a woman are not married. They have a child. The woman in disgrace gives the child up for adoption. 7 years later, on the scene comes Stud, and he wants his baby. And what do the courts do? He's the father. Give them the baby. Well, that's so good for the child after 7 years. And I'm sure it certainly didn't pull at the heartstrings of the adopted parents. It's the way it is anymore. A person was talking to me recently about an adoption principle. I said, that's the last thing people should get involved in. There's no guarantees anymore. What's written on paper doesn't mean a thing. Proof of that, of course, is try to get a warranty or a guarantee on a product that you own that broke. And they start in, they put the hat on, they come out with the cane, and they've got this group in the back with trombones, you know, the whole thing. Up yours, you know, that's... Try it, you'll never get it, you know. Well, Yeah, I had a problem once with a carburetor on my son's car. You know what a guy suggested? Now, this was the solution. Buy a new car. Yeah, that's a real good solution. Although I did tell someone just the other evening, I think the only solution for your problem is to take your radiator cap and pop it off and hold it about here and drive a new one under it and just put it down and close it. That'd be a good warranty, wouldn't it? You have to keep the old radiator cap. You want to see the way they look at you when you bring your automobile back, if you have to, under warranty. They won't even admit when they send out notices that there's something faulty in the vehicle. They won't even admit it. But you sent me the letter. No, we never sent a letter. No, this company never sent a letter with that regard. Then how come I got it fixed free elsewhere? Well, they did it wrong. And I'm not a thief either. Hey, the President of the United States, see? What's happened to integrity in this country? And look what we got in the White House. You know, I almost threw up the other day when he was talking about VE Day. And he's up there and he's saying, and our soldiers, and I kept screaming in the television, drop the gun! Unfortunately, he never heard me. And you could see these VFW guys, you know, with medals all the way around hanging from their nose, sitting there going, look like old bulldogs. Of course, they look that way anyway, but I just kind of superimpose my thoughts into theirs. Yeah, you just keep thinking about that. Can you imagine a man who was a conscientious objector during Vietnam and escaped the draft, having the audacity and the gall to stand before the American people and talk about how great a sacrifice it was for our boys to go and fight overseas? Blech! See, that's criticism. But he's still the president. But not for long. You say, what are you going to do? Vote. As I do every year. And I have such satisfaction when I see somebody coming out of that Democratic booth. I say, I just canceled your vote. But if I wasn't there, I just voted for who he voted for. How do you like that? Maybe I'll save that until next November. Did y'all look up those verses I gave you last night? Yeah, sure. Let's see. Tomorrow's the millennium, right? Let me give them to you again for tomorrow evening, because that's where we begin tomorrow night. Ephesians 6:16, Psalm 16:11, Proverbs 3:13, John 15:11, 1 Thessalonians 1:6, Philippians 4:11, 1 Timothy 6:6 through 8, Psalm 146, verse 5, Psalm 128, verse 1, Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. By the way, if you start tonight, you'll probably get through by tomorrow's Bible class. Philippians 4, 6 through 7. Nehemiah 8, verse 10. You know what Nehemiah 8:10 says? The happiness of the Lord is your strength. Isn't that great? 1 Peter 1, 3 through 9. We'll study these tomorrow night as we are ready to move into the final phase called faith execution. Let's pray. You're dismissed. Thank you, Father, for the time that we've spent together. Thank you for giving to us so great a plan, including that problem-solving device, sharing with thy happiness. How we thrilled to know that regardless of the circumstances in life, thou hast provided an answer in many cases before we even have the questions. Dismiss us now, we ask. In Christ's name, amen.